And essentially, we're supposed to be eyes and ears of the taxpayer, keeping an eye on what the district is doing with its bond funds, and and writing a report once a year to say, yes, they did it right, no, they did it wrong, you know, we think they took these measures that were good, we think they should do these other things. That is your role. And if you look at 17001 here, it specifically articulates that you're supposed to make sure that the money is only spent on construction, rehabilitation, or replacement of college facilities.
Where is that?
17001.
What page?
Page 19. Okay. And that we aren't using any money for teachers or administrators. That is, you know, your charge. In other words, make sure we're spending the money the way we said we were going to spend the money. Now, would that that were a simple idea. However, it's a very big agency. And so we find ourselves with a lot of complexity and nuance. These are things that you're specifically suggested that you might do in looking at things. For example, the law requires an annual financial audit and an annual performance audit. The financial audit is, does everybody know where the money went? And the performance audit is, how well did we do? Were we tied back to the project list and that sort of stuff? So what will happen is once a year, and this will happen in, I'm going to say, the February meeting, you'll have the auditors that the district has hired come report to you on what they found and what their exceptions are and what their concerns are. And just to give you an example, one of the things that happened over the last year was that we identified that money was spent on a building that probably shouldn't have been spent on that building. And you might ask yourself, how does that happen? Why does that happen? In that, just to play out the example for you, this particular one involves a sheriff's station at Southwest. When a particular building was identified, the sheriff's station was expected to be within that. When the college split it out separately, nobody thought, oh gosh, now we can't do it because now it's a separate building and that sort of stuff. And you may ask yourself, what's the remedy when that happens? Our bond counsel has written an opinion saying, if you mess up, you just need to stop doing it. You don't have to pay the money back, but you need to stop doing it. So if you realize that you've made a mistake, you need to stop and take corrective measures.
You don't have to tear the building down, right?
That's right. You don't have to tear the building down. So one of the things that will happen is you'll get a report about how we've spent the money and errors that we found on our own, errors that the auditors found, and you'll have an opportunity to look at that. The nature of this committee is that it is statutorily mandated, so it must meet, and it must be by the legislature.
By the state.
So
and the governance and the bond.
Right. When you seek to pass in the old days, when you sought to ask the taxpayers for money to build buildings, it required a two-thirds vote. The Constitution of California was changed so that it could pass on a 55% vote. But if you do, you must have a group of citizens like you who will sit and review how the money is spent and whether it was spent appropriately. And so that's part of a condition of our bond measures. In this particular case, the Board of Trustees not only specified this district-wide committee, but also specified that there would be a committee at each college as well. And the reason for that is because it's a big place. It's big and it's complicated, and it's really hard for a group of volunteers to drill down into the detail. In addition to that, the Board of Trustees structured the committee so that it would have a representative from each college as well as certain other kinds of at-large positions. So just to pick an example, Donna serves as the representative from the on the committee. you serve as the foundation representative. And so each vote is equal, but what happens is that so they're the campus representatives and then kind of the at-large representatives. Everybody is limited to 2 2-year terms in sequence. So after 4 years, you get termed out, and then somebody else can come on. We have had people who were on the committee before who've come back to the committee because they were familiar with the program and wanted to serve. So if you look down at the next section here in 17002, you'll see the list of the makeup of the different positions on the committee. So you have 9 college representatives and then 8 other people. Some of those are the ones that are mandated by statute, and some of those are of our own making. For example, the statute requires that we have a representative who is active from a senior citizens organization, but the district specified adding a couple of at-large positions as well as adding a labor representative to our program in order to make sure that we met all of those needs. Okay? Everybody with me so far? So the committee will meet. The committee had met quarterly for the first 10 years or so of its existence, and last year made a decision to meet every other month because of the volume of materials and activities. There is no express statement that says if you miss 3 meetings, you're out. On the other hand, we were criticized by the state controller's office for the effectiveness of the body. And so we kind of feel like we need to button down on people a little harder about attending. And I will tell you, having been to many a college citizens committee, it's hard to get a quorum because it's a big group, but also because we're mandated by law to make you serve as volunteers. So what we can give you is a sandwich over there and a firm handshake and a warm thank you.
Will we get a calendar of dates in advance? Because this I got 1 week ago.
Yes, what will happen is you guys will agree to the dates. You guys will adopt an annual calendar, and you'll adopt in the first year, the first meeting of the calendar year every year, this committee then selects a chair and vice chair for the year.
It's in here too, the dates.
Of course those are subject to the committee's change. Now, one of the questions often is, well, what if we have an issue about a particular activity that's gone on? The majority of the committee may vote to ask for a special auditor investigation. And what's important is to understand that this committee cannot be funded with bond money. It must be funded with the district's operational money. And so we have to we have to go to our operational fund and staff whatever that is. But any one member of the committee doesn't have the authority to order an investigation or an audit. It takes a majority vote of the committee. And you can imagine why that might be, particularly with 16 people. The Board of Trustees can also do the same sort of thing. So in addition to the annual audit, and the annual performance, the annual financial audit, and the annual performance audit, you can order special audits. Finally, the Board of Trustees has retained an inspector general as a specific effort to ensure the integrity of the program. That is a bond-funded activity, and the board awarded a contract with Policy Masters, and Christine Marnes is the inspector general, who's the lead, and they look at all kinds of issues that come up over time. They are bond-funded. If they get assigned to do work for you, that will come from the general fund. It cannot come from the bond money as well. So those are some of the fundamental measures. So your purpose is to keep an eye on us. That's your purpose. Elliot does that so well. To ask questions and that sort of stuff. And I will say, a $6 billion construction program is no small thing. It is enormously complex, and we have a lot of different nuances and also a lot of different moving parts. So it is not unusual in these settings for somebody to use a set of initials that is mysterious and you know, talking about DB or CPMs or DBCs or whatever it is. You should always feel free to ask for clarification on what somebody is talking about, because the district, like any organization, develops its own subculture of terms, and in addition to that, the bond program has its own subculture of terms. And it's important, as members of the Citizens Committee, that you keep an eye on us, and you can't really do that if you don't know what we're talking about, right? So that's the first thing. The second thing is you need to know that this committee is governed by the public meeting law. And the public meeting law is called the Brown Act, the Ralph M. Brown Act. And what the Ralph M. Brown Act says is that meetings of certain kinds of bodies have to be conducted in a setting that's completely accessible to the public. So that means that these meetings need to be conducted so that any member of the public, whatever person who wants to come, can come and listen to what's going on. And we can't ask them who they are. They're entitled to attend absolutely anonymously, although people who come generally don't want to be anonymous, but they generally want you to know that they're there. But they're entitled to sit and listen to what you have to say. They're also entitled, as members of the public, to have some public speaker time and tell you what they think of what the district is doing in terms of its program and what they think of what you're doing, and whether they like it or not. And they're usually quite generous in sharing their opinions with the committee. That may be a little intimidating, especially if you haven't served on a public board before, but that it is their free speech rights to do. So you may remember civics class, you have the right to petition your government. Well, guess what? In this setting, you're the government. Even though you're the government keeping the eyes on the government, but that's what it is. So we have at both the Board of Trustees meetings, at this meeting, at all kinds of Brown Act meetings throughout the district, members of the public who come and express their opinions vigorously and perhaps viscerally. And I say to you, well, words won't hurt you. So, you know, you listen, and you listen respectfully. That's what your job is to do.
Can this committee have a closed session?
You could only have a closed session if it fit within the parameters of the Brown Act. And the Brown Act says everything's open unless it fits within a specific exception. There are very few things that would be likely in my mind that this committee would have the authority and jurisdiction to have a closed session over. For example, one of the things that the Board of Trustees might have a closed session over is evaluation of a public employee like me. Okay? I have a reasonable right of privacy in my employment. The Board of Trustees can have a closed session. But you guys don't decide whether I work for the LACCD. So you can't have a closed session. In addition to that, a member of the public is entitled to come and criticize a public employee in the performance of his or her work. So Tom over there, you know, somebody wants to say Tom doesn't know how to, you know, manage his way out of a paper bag or whatever. They can say that. They're entitled to do that. It doesn't mean you have to act on it. And you don't have any authority over anybody's employment. So the basis under which you would be able to have a closed session would be very, very limited, if at all, in my opinion.
Can you give us an example of one where we could?
Well, if the community actually sued you and named you, then we would probably be able to have a closed session. So far, that has not happened. And since Elliot always wants me to mention this, if you're sued for what you do in the course and scope of your decision-making here, the district will provide you with a defense because you're acting as a volunteer. If, however, you do something that isn't involved in reading something and making an assessment, but something that's outside that, like punching somebody in the nose, we aren't going to help you with that. Okay? So You.
Camille, did you distribute that document that you distributed to us in the past to the new members?
I did not.
I think it would be a good idea.
Okay.
Camille has reduced this director's insurance, as it's commonly called. It's not called in this setting. Has reduced it to words, the good words, and you should all have a copy of it. It says what she says, but
yeah, and because you had commented that I should add that to the District Citizens Oversight Committee
right.
handbook, I figured when we redistributed the handbook, we would put that in as
Super.
An attachment.
So are you saying that you have D&O insurance, or are you saying that the
she has what she described? She had. I use the term director's insurance.
The district has a lot of different kinds of insurance. We have what's called errors and omissions insurance, okay? So let's say somebody sued this body and said, you were not diligent in your work. First of all, you don't have a separate legal capacity from the district as a body. You're like the district-wide budget committee or anything like that. But we would provide you with a defense. We technically have errors and omissions coverage, but the deductible or self-insured retention is what it's called in this case, is $1 million. So we tend to be self-insured to $1 million for most things. If, however, you get sued because you've done something that's outside of reading material, making assessment, making a decision, something that involves affirmatively malicious conduct, then the district can't provide you with representation. And the best example of that is you get mad at a member of the public and decide to take a swing. I can't help you with that. Please don't do that, okay?
You'd be sympathetic.
Well,
not officially.
but if somebody says your decision was a bad one, we provide you with representation. Yes.
Kind of add a question. If there was a judgment given some wild circumstance
yeah.
against the committee or any one of us individually, and you were defending us, is that judgment covered by the district also?
The answer is as long as it doesn't arise out of malicious or conduct. So, for example, or involve punitive damages. And let me go back to the punching somebody in the nose because it's just easy to understand. If somebody has a judgment against you, sues you and alleges that Marv punched him in the nose, okay, we're not going to provide Marv with a defense. However, if your suit is a body and somebody says your decision was bad and you should have punitive damages awarded against you, the district is legally precluded from paying for those. But that requires a finding of malicious conduct. And you're not likely to put yourself in that situation. If all you did was make a decision that just wasn't that good one, and the court finds that, which is really, really unlikely, okay, then the district provides that coverage for you. So you have to do something that requires specifically acting out affirmatively with malicious intent in order to find yourself with personal exposure. And that's probably intuitive to you anyway. If you ask your grandmother, should the district provide you with representation if you just make a bad decision compared to hitting somebody in the nose, your grandmother would probably say, well, you have the control over whether you hit somebody in the nose, right? So that's an extreme example.
Punitive damages normally are tied to intent, right?
Right, that's
so
right.
If we intended to be malicious, if we intended to mislead.
Right. You'd have to be, and that would really be pretty extraordinary. People may be critical from a political standpoint or a public standpoint, but about whether you do your work. But the likelihood of, as long as you don't engage in affirmatively malicious conduct, we're fine. The affirmatively malicious conduct that you might find yourself inadvertently engaging in is commenting publicly on your opinion regarding an individual contractor or an individual member of the community. To which I suggest to you that if you aren't familiar with issues of defamation, now is a good time. But when you're talking, your responsibility as a member of this committee is to look at what we provide you, but also to make due diligence inquiries. And this particular setting, which is a public meeting, is a privileged setting. So you're entitled to raise inquiries in this setting that contain a greater protection than your comments just outside on the street.
The other thing that you should add to this, and I came in a couple minutes late, so maybe you already said something in this direction. We are not making decisions for expenditures of money, nor the selection of contractors. This committee's charge is to review the bond expenditures and make recommendations to the Board of Trustees. We are not making decisions on how we spend money, except in the form of recommendations
right.
to the Board of Trustees, who make those decisions and the expenditure of funds.
Right. It's important to know that you retain an individual right to address the Board of Trustees, so if you want to go to the Board of Trustees meeting and tell them what you think, you're entitled to do that. In addition to that, this committee formally adopts recommendations as a committee that go to the Board of Trustees. What you can't do is hold yourself out as speaking on behalf of the committee when the committee as a whole hasn't voted in that regard.
Is this committee member, is there history of being publicly exposed? That is there any occasion where we might be approached by the press?
Yes, there is. Especially in the last couple of years.
I would say the best thing is no comment.
and if we are approached, what is your...
Well, you have a free speech right, okay? So I can't tell you you mustn't speak to them. You have a free speech right. But I would suggest to you that you be judicious in the exercise of your free speech right and understand that it's not unusual for media to try to push you into saying something negative or whatever, and let me encourage you to exercise your best judgment in that regard. You have a free speech right, just like every employee of the district. What you can't do is hold yourself out as speaking on behalf of the committee, unless the committee's designated you that way.
I have one more question.
Before you do that, let me just comment on this comment. You also have to appreciate the fact that when you speak with the press, it's their interpretation of what you've said that appears in writing, and that may suit.
Or excerpts thereof.
Yeah, so that may, even if you're judicious in what you have to say, you need to be aware of the fact that what appears in print may be different.
Right.
Sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. Thanks.
There is something called media training that, you know, executives often go through about not getting misquoted and that sort of stuff. So it can be a very sophisticated exchange.
Yeah, that's a good one. I've been hit, so most of us have, I think. I never heard a clarification on this. Intercommittee communication, emails.
That's right where I'm going.
Oh.
Thank you so much.
Sorry.
And what a fabulous segue. So, Since this committee is governed by the public meeting law, a majority of the committee cannot develop a consensus outside the public view. Now, the upside of having 17 members is it's really hard to get that many people to agree. I always like to make a joke about, can you really get that many people to agree? but you have what happens is you'll get stuff electronically. For example, if a press release goes out, you'll get a copy of that press release by an email. What you have to be careful about is using the reply all, because you say, well, the committee should do this. The email doesn't have a lot of security attached to it, but it isn't a noticed public meeting. And so you can't develop a consensus as a committee or a majority of the committee outside the public view. So you can't make a round. You are entitled to make individual contacts. So Elliot could call each one of you and say, I am putting this item forward. Will you support it? He can do that. What he can't do is say, Richard's supporting it. Will you support it? Bob's supporting it. Will you support it? Until he develops a majority. Okay. So you can't share opinions from one representative to another. And the reason for that is...
This communication can take place in email, so he could forward that email just to me.
Yes, that's right. And so the issue of communication applies whatever medium you use. So it doesn't matter whether it's on telephone, by email, by fax machine, you know, by Facebook. I don't think we have a Facebook group yet, but you never know. any of those things. So, in other words, the public is entitled to hear your deliberations as a group. And so you have to respect that. And what comes up the most often is we send an email to the committee with the agenda, and somebody hits back reply all, somebody else hits back reply all, and now not only have we violated the Brown Act, but we've made a document, public document, showing that, which is not good. Violating the public meeting law creates an issue in terms of intentional violations in the extreme or a misdemeanor.
I suggest that, you know, in the email distribution, that the attendees be put in BCC. Okay, if you put it in BCC, those names do not appear, and you can't forward to the entire committee.
Yeah, it's a lot harder to do. I agree.
You can forward, but
the addresses aren't there.
I strongly urge BCC. I send out.
I believe
memos
that we should absolutely.
My
do
members
that.
Always under BCC.
Now, the other thing that's important to understand is that anything that's provided to you for a public meeting is also required to be contemporaneously available to the public. So. If you've ever been in the lobby of our district office, you'll see volumes and volumes of material there, and those are our public access materials. So if I send you a memo, I need to make sure that it is also available to the public at the same time, and so we specifically put it there. Unique to this committee is an interesting requirement, which is members of the community can submit items to you, which is happens with every kind of committee, but unique to this committee is that those must be posted on the district's website as well. So whatever any member of the public comes and brings to you, we also upload to the website. And that's mandated by law, and it's what we will do, and it's required. So understand that we get public records requests every day. Okay,
so what
for
I hear
massive
you say,
quantities of documents.
So what I hear you say is if somebody sends us an email regarding our tasks, okay, and it's directed just to us, we should forward it to you or to the school, and they will post it.
Yeah.
We're not responsible to post.
That's right. That's exactly
okay.
right.
Okay.
And
well,
if it's provided to you, The only things that are required to be posted are those things that are provided by the staff. So if a member of the community writes to you, or even writes to all of you, we're not required to post that prior to the meeting, but we may be required to post that eventually on the website, which is a little bit different issue. So all this big pile of documents that you got, those were all downstairs in the lobby from the time that they were sent out to you.
And they're also on the website, are they?
Yeah.
And in addition, the meetings.
Is the district website that
yes.
you're
we have a, well, we have a section. We have a section. Maybe you should provide that to people as well.
We predominantly use the website, the LACCD Builds Green website, because it's specifically tied to the bond program, and the jurisdiction of this committee is tied to the program. So if there's something that you want to bring before this committee, what's important to know is that the public is entitled to know that in advance of the meeting too. You can't show up and just say, hey, I want to talk about this, because then we aren't giving the public notice. So we have to post 72 hours in advance legally as a minimum, but you don't want to send it 73 hours in advance. The agenda comes out a week ahead of time, and if there's something that you want to add to it, we can do that. But we need to post it so that a member of the public knows that the issue is being raised. Okay.
And one other thing on this point, the public meetings are recorded, okay, and the recordings are placed on that website as well.
Axelrod.
Elliot Axelrod. He's the vice chair of the committee.
Okay. I know, but I'm sitting here because this is the center of gravity of this group.
Yeah, we're just for this. Elliot suggested that we, because we're doing this orientation for the new members, that we focus down here.
Yeah, Bob, do we need to say our name for the recording? Anyway, Bob Courtney. Two questions. I'm thinking about when I said inter-committee communications. Let's say any one of us has an idea. I want to kind of bounce it off everybody else. There's nothing to vote on, just an idea of situation. No.
No. The Brown Act will not allow that.
What you have to do is get it onto the agenda.
That's right.
Okay, and then discuss it.
Well, you have to communicate that to the agenda.
You could have that communication
with one or two or three
people, but you can't have it with a quorum.
Oh, no, I'm not looking. Yeah, okay. And then the other thing is, I did get communications a number of times from this Danny Camp group directly to me.
Okay. Now, was it to you individually?
Yeah, I think it was, but okay. It may have been sent to others. I've often wondered, this is down what you're talking about right now.
Yeah, you don't have an obligation to do anything with that unless you want to. But if there's something that's submitted to the committee as a whole, we have an obligation to post that.
Yes. I have not received anything from.
Yeah. Well, and people, members of the community may well send you an email about this, that, or the other thing. You are entitled, though, if there's something that
do
wasn't.
Do they have our emails?
They've made public records requests for them, and for phone numbers, and so has the Los Angeles Times. We feel that we generally have an obligation to provide the names of the committee and some vehicle for communication with a committee member, but we've made, you know, a committee member may ask for a phone number to be withheld and only an email, for example, or something like that.
If you get annoyed by a barrage, you can exclude them, you know, block them out. You can filter them out. So.
Yes.
Like on the emails, we're using our personal ones, or can we use to have a?
We can assign you a district email if you'd like one.
Yeah.
Tom,
that might be good.
Can you help with that? Figure out anybody
that wants.
Well, but then you have to get into the district system. So.
Well, then I'd rather do that.
Well, ultimately, the district could resend that email to you.
We have frequently.
There are people who aren't full time with the district who use a district email address and it forwards automatically to their personal email address. We do get public records requests for emails. I would say that just to give you an example. Right now, we have a public records request for emails from 120 people, which is beyond my comprehension, but somehow there's somebody shoveling through them. Fortunately, not me.
So if anybody wants a district email, Lillian is the person that would be the contact for this group, and she can make arrangements.
Thank you, Tom. I should have thought of that. I'm sorry. If there's something that's come up and you want to talk about it, it doesn't mean you can never talk about it. It just means it has to be appropriately agendized. So you can ask at a meeting, I'd like to have this included on the next agenda. And we can try to do that. One of the challenges this committee in particular faces is the time limitation. With only 2 hours in this vast program, it's difficult to get through everything that you want to get through. It's 17 people and only 2 hours every other month, but we can certainly, you're certainly entitled to say you'd like to see something else on the agenda. This has particularly happened when members of the community have raised a particular issue or request for something to be included.
And I don't think you have to do this 2 months in advance, which is a 2-month delay if you do that. You bring it up in a meeting and then it's discussed at the next meeting. I think you can send an email to the chair of the committee, Nancy Carson. She's not here today, but you can send one between times, correct me if I'm wrong, and then there is an agenda setting meeting that she and I and the chancellor have, and we can consider those for the next meeting. So you don't have to wait the 2 months by only bringing it up at the meeting. Is that correct?
Right, okay. Right. Now, a lot of times I get questions about being able to call into the meeting. And the rules on, because it's a Brown Act meeting, one of the issues is that wherever you as a member of the body are, a member of the public has to be able to see and hear everything you can see and hear. I have had in the past a member of the Board of Trustees swear to me that she posted the agenda on the door of her hotel in New York and opened the door and let any member of the public come walk in, which is kind of crazy. But you can't call in at the last minute. So if you get the flu or something, you just won't be here. Because we have to post those locations 72 hours in advance, and a member of the community has to be able to access that site. So
okay. The exception might be that I could call in and listen, but I can't talk. Is that correct?
That's an interesting question, and I'd have to look at that. I don't think that's completely within the spirit of the law. It may be technically true, but I would say it's...
I believe it's technically true.
Yeah, well, it's probably technically true, but that might be. Let me look at that for you. So there's that. So let me move on, if I could, to conflict of interest questions. One of the things that happens with this many people is that you have different business interests throughout the district. And this, although we've tried to create a plain English draft of a conflict of interest checklist for you to ask yourself, where might I have a conflict of interest? We're still refining that. And one of the issues is that there are some that are statutory that are quite clear. For example, you cannot be a vendor to the district. You cannot be an employee of the district to be sitting on this committee. There are members of the community who say that retirees cannot be on this committee, but the district does not agree because we feel you're no longer employed by the agency. So as far as we're concerned, retirees are just fine.
No minimum separation time?
No, although, you know, I mean, something.
15 years.
Well, but anyway, the point is that the law does not preclude that at this point. But there are some other areas of potential conflict of interest that might arise in terms of who you do business with. So you have to be alert to your relationships to the rest of the universe and how it crosses over. So if you, in the course of looking at materials, you see somebody that, you know, is doing construction work on your house or whatever, you should raise that issue and raise that concern, because it's important that you not engage in that activity. If you have a conflict of interest, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're not on the committee. So a conflict of interest being an employee of the district or a vendor to the district, you can't be on the committee. But a conflict of interest, I do business with, pick a contractor, okay, doesn't result in you're not being able to be on the committee, but it does probably mean that you have to step out of the room and not participate in the discussion at all.
You'd have to self-exclude yourself.
That's right. And we don't know all of your business. Only you know all of your business. And so you have to pay attention to those issues for your own right. If you happen to have a relative who works for a contractor who's under discussion in this room, you should be asking yourself, should I be participating in this discussion? Better to ask the question than not. And I said, we're trying to translate this to plain English for normal people, because conflict of interest involves both financial concerns and other kinds of personal or organizational concerns. And it's not necessarily, a lot of people don't necessarily think of that, and you just need to be aware that it's an issue. It's less about being sure what the answer is than understanding that there's a question. In other words, you can't know the answer to everything in this life. You just can't. You have to, but you're the one who's in a position to identify that there's a question you should be asking.
But it's not our responsibility to search that out. But when we become knowledgeable of it, then to take action.
That's right. Okay. That's right. And so that's what you need to do. I'd like to turn now a little bit to talk a little bit about the district. Some of you have the benefit of knowing more about the LA Community College district than others, and I thought it might be a good idea to just talk about the district in broad terms. Bless you. We have 9 colleges. We have 12 major locations. The nine colleges have their primary sites. In addition to that, we have the district office, which is across the street here. This space is rented as swing space or temporary space because of the construction going on at the district office. And so so it is bond funded. So we consider this sort of part of the district office, even though it's physically a separate building. There's the Vandy Camp site, and there's a site at Southgate. And at Southgate, we have a leased space, and across the street is the space that we've purchased, but we haven't built out for college use yet. And so I've kind of glommed those into one location, only because in the long term, they will be one location. And so that's how we have the 12 major locations. At any given moment, we have about 150,000 students in class, and over the course of any given year, about 200,000 students who enroll. And they take all kinds of different programs. Some of them are training to be LVNs or welders or any other kind of certificate, or paralegals, or cooks, chefs, or whatever. Some of them are preparing to transfer to a four-year institution, and they transfer to four-year institutions everywhere. You know, we have a partnership with the historically black colleges and universities, so they transfer not just to colleges and universities here locally, but literally across the country. We have a chancellor who's the CEO of the organization. And each college is headed by a college president that has its own executive team. And so people like Tom Hall and I work at the district office and report to the chancellor, who reports to the board of trustees, and the college presidents manage their own executive teams, and they report to the chancellor. We have six employee unions that represent employees in different bargaining units, and so they have a lot of interests here as well.
What are the six?
The six, it's like a pop quiz. We have a unit that's the clerical technical unit. So that would be secretaries, cashiers, accountants, that kind of group. We have a unit that's called the supervisory unit, and that's the people to whom those people report that do business functions of some kind. We have a unit of the faculty unit, which is the biggest unit and has 4,000 to 5,000 members in it, and they are the ones that teach classes. We have an academic administrators unit, which is deans, associate deans, assistant deans, and their supervisory. What number am I on?
Four.
We have a unit that's called Local 99, which is gardeners, custodians,
maintenance, perhaps.
What?
Maintenance, perhaps.
Well, a lot of the maintenance unit is in the buildings and construction trades unit, which is our sixth unit. So that's going to have the electricians, the plumbers, all the people with specialty kinds of licenses that do that kind of work. The painters are in building and construction trades.
Yeah.
And carpenters. So we have, each campus has those kinds of people too. I got all six, right?
You did. That's and five was passing.
Yeah. I've only been representing the agency 19 years. At this point, I ought to be able to do that. So where was I? Oh, yes. In addition to that, the district, by state law, has a process that's known colloquially as shared governance or participatory governance. And what that means is that the state law mandates that both the staff and the students and the academic staff, which would be, you know, faculty and academic administrators, have an opportunity to participate and provide input into decision making. So even though the managers are ultimately responsible for making decisions, there's an openness and an opportunity for people to contribute their ideas to the policies and procedures of the district. And that means that we have what probably seems like a lot of committees. And some of those committees are required to comply with the Brown Act, and some of them are not, depending on how they were formed and that sort of thing. The most of the so, for example, the all the vice presidents of academic affairs get together once a month, and they're trying to share best practices, but also formulate policy for the district. But there's also a committee that will be, rather than a group of counterparts, will be specifically a group of people who represent different constituencies and ideas. For example, we have the district-wide budget committee, also known as the DBC. And that group specifically helps make recommendations to the chancellor regarding how the operational money that we get gets allocated. And as you might imagine, there's some controversy over those things. On the bond side, we have a bond steering committee, and that bond steering committee, meets once a month and addresses those things. And so different kinds of decisions are consulted in different kind of groups. And that takes a little bit longer, but it means that we have the benefit of a lot of different people's thinking. In particular, I find that I craft something that articulates a policy, and somebody who's actually going to have to implement it may have some really good ideas about where the holes might be or the questions might be, and it gives us an opportunity to get the input. Ultimately, our budget is on the operational side is $500 to $600 million per year, and the bond program is the one-time money, if you will, of the $6 billion. So we can use operational money to do things that support the bond program, but we must not use bond money to replace what we need to do in the operational program. So it's important that we don't use it to teach classes or anything like that. And that, of course, makes it really interesting in these times where we're down approximately 25% in the number of classes we've been able to offer, to be out building buildings and at the same time trying to talk about not being able to teach classes in those buildings. So I think now we should talk a little bit about how the building program is managed, and I really ought to defer to Tom unless you want me to just keep talking.
No, that's fine. So
Tom is the Executive Director of Facilities Planning and Development.
Tom
Hall. And Tom is in the role on an interim basis. That's Tom. See? Yes.
One of the problems
I'm
now
sitting
is
over there. I'm just so
good
at hearing
that. That's why the new people might
right.
know who's doing.
Thank you. Yes. And she, of course, she already knows I'm the general counsel. I do a lot of general counseling. It's kind of a joke. I'm the lawyer for the district. Tom.
So from the perspective of the building program, myself, I'm the interim executive director of facilities planning development. We are doing a search for executive director position, and that will take place this next year. You know, so they've already had it advertised. But this position reports to the chancellor, and the chancellor reports to the board. So reporting to me is the program director of the bond program. Also reporting to me are some people that are district staff that are doing facilities planning and development stuff for the district that are non-bond. So it'd be dealing with state funds, dealing with federal funds that are not considered part of this bond program, but they are tied to the bond program because some of that money supplements some of these projects. The bond director is stationed at our office at 915 Wilshire on the 8th floor, and it is, we call it Build LACCD. And the reason we call it Build LACCD is because it's a compilation of several different companies. There, I think there's 13 companies in the program director's office. And URS is the lead on that, and most of these companies are subs to URS or contracted by the district either way. But they all make up this unit that we call Build LACCD. Build LACCD is not a legal entity. It's just the branding. So they have no government function at all. So that's what takes place in the program. level. The program level reviews invoices and helps with policies and communications with different entities and sets up programs like commissioning or ADA compliance and those type of things.
When he says program level, he means district-wide.
District-wide level, yeah. Yes.
Just, when you say build LA, you know, is that under DBA rules or is that
no.
just pure fictional?
It's purely fictional. Yeah, okay. It's just a branding thing.
Yeah, so then each of our colleges have what's called a college project management team. And right now we have 9 different college project management teams, and each college actually has a different team at this point. And if you take any one of the colleges, they're going to be dealing with the actual projects that are being built. Most of the stuff on the program management function, Build LACC, are considered soft costs. Most of the stuff that's being done at the colleges, a lot of it's considered hard costs. You know, so we're kind of set up that way, so the projects get developed by the colleges and the shared governance. That information goes through the program team, and the program team also helps develop the board agenda items that go to the board for approval by the board. And so all those functions on the program team, the Build LACC team, report through my office, but the CPMs, the college project managers, report through the presidents and then to the chancellor. So there's kind of a two-structured system there, because all the college project managers report through the president to the chancellor, and I report to the chancellor also, but it's for the program-wide stuff.
Tom, is there an organization chart that can be made available to us? We've always talked
sure.
about these things, but it's much easier if we distribute an org chart.
In fact, I think we supplied that once before, but we'll get it to you guys.
Thank you.
So anyhow, so the structure is 9 college project management teams that report to the presidents, and the presidents report to the chancellor. The overall program team that covers all the stuff like audit and invoicing and all that stuff goes through my office, and then I report to the chancellor. So the chancellor has everybody report to them, and then the board of trustees is the group that takes the action on the agenda items we put forward.
Okay, so essentially you have a matrix organization, you know, where you're set up, but the board actually approves all expenditures. Okay,
that's
all
right.
Okay, where is the design, architectural design, and you know, submittal up to the what do you call it? The California
Division of State Architect.
Division of State Architects. Okay, so
is that soft cost?
Yeah, a lot of it is.
So that's also soft costs at the college.
There are some soft costs at the college. The design of a project would normally be considered soft cost. Just to give you a difference, what happens at the college, the team, they hire an architect to design a project. What we do at the program team is we help develop the criteria that we want that to be within. So we want to say that, you know, we have, and the direction usually comes from the trustees and others, you know, and we may say, we want, when you design something, we want backs on all the benches. Okay, so that becomes a program-wide directive, and then it's up to us at the program to share that with the colleges, and the colleges have to incorporate that into their design. Or another one that just came up at our board meeting was potty parity. So that means that, you know, that the amount of toilets you have are not the same number. It means the amount of wait time that you have for the different groups is the same. So, you know, that's one of the things the board has recommended. Another thing that they want to see is us using sustainable green type standards to build things. So we help develop those district-wide guidelines, and we share that with the colleges, and then the colleges develop the projects.
What if a college decides to hire an architect who's really very much in favor of a particular architect, and your experience has been not good with that architect? Do you have any veto power, or is it just you can advise and recommend, but...
It depends on the level of interaction we've had with that company, but mostly, you know, it's mostly advice, you know. But if we know something that is not good, you know, we'll share it with them. You know, things that they need to look out for. You know, that's the advantage of having a program this size, is that if we have issues, like we know somebody's not good at closing out their documentation, you know, we tell them that up front, you know, they need to pay attention to this because they're not good at closing out the documentation, and make sure you follow up with them on a regular basis. You know, so there are things like that. But if we actually go to the extent of terminating a contract, which we have before, we share that with the program too. You know, because there are those instances where we may have an issue where we have to let somebody go because of for reason.
But so if you did terminate someone, a college could just, or could they, if they had been terminated before somewhere?
Depends on what the reason is for the termination. If it's for cause, then, you know, they aren't going to be able to bring that person back in. But if it's for convenience, then they have the ability to bring that person back in.
And how you meet, I guess, with all college CPMs regularly?
Yes, we meet regularly with the CPMs to go over agenda items that they want to put forward to the board for review, to make sure there's budget available, make sure that the projects are actually on the bond list that was approved by the voters, make sure that it's using the right source of funds. Those are all things that we've really made a greater emphasis on that this last six to 12 months. We've really started cracking down on that.
So it regularly means something like every month, or what's regularly?
Actually, I meet with the CPMs twice a month to go over their agenda items that they're putting forward.
2 minutes before the public meeting starts.
I just had a quick question. Isn't there an element of discretionary fund expenditures within these different programs?
There was, to a certain extent, but one of the things you'll see in our meeting today is we started nailing down the budgets. And I know you've been gone a little bit, but you know, you've done some things since you've been gone that I think you'll be glad to see.
Good.
That.
Good, thanks.
I was going to say those soft costs that you were talking about, however, are included in are funded by the bond. For the architectural work and what have you. It's not just the construction.
What is the ratio now?
I think we're going to finish the program somewhere around 23% soft costs, which is on the low side.
Yeah.
Early in the program, we were close to 20-30, but there was a lot of planning and design and producing of EIRs and
so your projection will be under 25% when it's all done?
Yeah, that's what we're projecting.
Elliot, before you call to order, may I suggest that we invite everybody to get their sandwiches? Sorry. Excuse me.
I'm going to be leaving in about 10 minutes.
Congratulations.
Hi, I'm doing.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Welcome.